So I am from, as Tim said, from the Centre for Emotional Health and from the Department of Psychology at Macquarie University. And I'm particularly interested in children's emotional health because I believe that if we can build children's emotional health, then it really sets the stage for healthy and productive lives for the children that we're raising. So there was a recent study in the London that came out of the London School of Economics that was published in Economics Journal, which I never read, but in this case I was, because what they found, even though I think as psychologists and as teachers and as people supporting children, we've known this for a long time, but I think it takes an economist to actually make a splash and make a difference in our knowledge, that they studied a group of children and adolescents and followed them through. This was in the UK actually. And we're looking at what were the predictors of adult life satisfaction. If we want to be raising healthy and productive adults, what kind of childhood predictors are most important? So they looked at how much money the family had, what kind of education the child had, behavioural problems, emotional health, a whole range of different issues, and they were tracking these children over time. And the strongest predictor of how satisfied and how happy an adult was their child emotional health. So their anxiety and depression. To me, well, I know this as a researcher, that's pretty strong evidence that if we want to raise healthy and productive adults, then the space is child emotional health. We need to make a difference in raising more emotionally healthy children. So how are we going with that? Are we actually raising emotionally healthy children and mentally healthy children? Well, we know from data in Australia that by the time a child reaches adulthood, one in four of them will have experienced a mental disorder. This is pretty astonishing, I think. Is anyone else shocked by that finding, or are you quite familiar with it already? One in four. I'm particularly interested in anxiety disorders, which make up a part of that one in four. I'm interested in anxiety because it's the most common mental health that children and adolescents experience, more common than eating disorders or behaviour disorders, and more common than depression, particularly in childhood. And it's also what we consider a gateway disorder, that if a child has problems with anxiety in childhood, then they're much more likely to develop problems with anxiety in adolescence and in adulthood as well, and more likely to develop a range of different mental disorders, so more likely to develop eating disorders or substance abuse problems. So, you know, if we really want to make a difference in raising healthy, happy adults, then being able to make an impact on this rate of anxiety disorders in young people. And we think between a 5 to 10% of our young people at any one time will be experiencing an anxiety disorder. It is also, out of all of the mental disorders that we see in a clinical practice, it's the one that starts the earliest. It has the earliest age of onset. So I'm trying to convince you that anxiety disorders are something that are worthy of our attention. I think in the past it's something that hasn't had as much attention, and it's tended to other disorders or other problems in children might have received more attention, but it is something that is important. And there's also some evidence that this number of children with anxiety disorders is on the rise. This is a bit controversial as well, because we're better at recognising emotional health problems, better at recognising anxiety. We're talking about it more. Here we are having a conference on mental health and emotional health. So we are getting better. The stigma, while it's still around, there is still stigma associated with mental health. But that has improved. And so we're better at being able to talk about anxiety problems, so people might be able to, just reporting it more. But perhaps the most convincing evidence that I've come across is, again, a study in the UK that tracked, actually looked at two different cohorts of children over a 20-year period and used actually the same instrument, so the same measure to measure emotional health symptoms. And over that 20-year period, there was a twofold increase in the rate of anxiety and depression that adolescents were reporting. So to me, this is fairly convincing evidence that, yes, this problem is increasing in our children. And I think from talking to teachers and to clinicians, I get the feeling that in the school setting that it is something that is anecdotally on the rise. Would people agree with that, that they're seeing more of it? Yeah, lots of head nods, yeah. So either they're presenting more or this problem is actually truly increasing. So we need to do something about it. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about what anxiety is and just tell you a little bit about why we think children might develop anxiety disorders, and also tell you a little bit about the strategies that we use both in prevention of anxiety and also in the treatment. But before I do that, anxiety, just I want to tell you just a little bit about what anxiety is and what it is, because it's actually a really normal emotion that everybody experiences. I always experience it a little bit before a presentation, and it's a really normal emotion. So I'm talking about anxiety disorders, which is something a little bit different, but anxiety is itself a really normal experience. So to demonstrate how normal it is, what I thought I would do is just to get maybe four people from this side of the room and four people from that side of the room just to come up, because it is a really normal experience, and I'm sure you can come up with something that has happened to you recently where you might have felt nervous. And I want you to tell me about four things. What the situation was, what you were anxious about, what happened in your body when you were nervous, what went through your head, and what you did. So those four things. So I'll just pick four people. You can just stay in your seats for now, and you just come up. You can just use this microphone, that's fine. You there, the smiling with the black and the brown, you can just stay there for now. You with the red, the scarf, yep, that's you, yep. Maybe somebody else in the back. The guy on the back table, nod your head, yes, you, yeah, great, okay. You down the front here with the tiger scarf, great. Purple jacket down the front here. Blue scarf there on that table, yes, unfortunately that's you. And maybe over two more in the back table. Where can we see? The guy down the back on the back table over there, yep, great, excellent. All right, so those four things, what happened, what you were thinking, what went through your body and what you did. All right, but before I do that, I'm going to actually get you to tell you that I'm not going to get you to come up and do that. But I want you just to sit and reflect on what you might be feeling, because I'm hoping that I just elicited just a tiny little bit of social anxiety. Would that be right? Yeah. So everyone who got chosen can now take a nice, soft breath, because you don't have to come up and talk about the most recent time you felt vulnerable or worried or... But it is a really normal emotion that everybody does experience. So I'll take you through some of the things that might have happened to you right then if you did experience some sort of rush of anxiety. You might have experienced something in your body, and this is one of the first things that happens with anxiety. Okay. one of the first things that happens with anxiety is something that happens in your body. So your body switches on. It's kind of like that flight or fight response. Where your body switches on to try and deal with whatever situation is coming your way. So you may have felt maybe a rush in your stomach. Your stomach might have dropped out. Anyone get that? Your heart might have started racing a little bit. Your hands might have been a bit sweaty. Or you just might have felt sick all of a sudden. Anyone get any physical sensations? Yeah? So that's kind of the physical response to anxiety. You might have had some thoughts that went through your head. We only feel anxious or fearful when we think something bad is going to happen. So if you thought you weren't going to be picked and you weren't worried about having to come up and potentially speak, then you wouldn't have felt nervous right then. Or if you knew I was tricking you. But we only feel nervous or scared when we think something bad is going to happen, and our thoughts are a really key component of anxiety. So you may have thought, oh, I really should have chosen that other program. Why did I choose the leadership program? I should have stayed longer for morning tea. But you also may have had other thoughts like, oh, what were the four things I had to talk about? Or what am I? I've got nothing to talk about. Or what if people laugh at me? Or what if I say something silly in front of people? Or what if I trip on the stairs coming up to the top here? So we only feel nervous when we think something bad is going to happen in the situation. And that's a really normal part of anxiety. All right, so actions. I did see a couple of actions because a few people turned their heads and just pretended to talk to the person next to them about something random, but they were avoiding my eye contact, so I didn't pick them. I didn't see anyone run for the door, which is a good thing. But usually when we feel nervous, our body prepares us to fight that situation or run away from it. And often our more natural response is to avoid situations that are that create anxiety. So kind of avoiding eye contact or running for the door, those sorts of things. So they're the kind of three main components of anxiety: what happens in your body, what goes through your head, and kind of your actions. And that as a really normal response. It can be elicited quite easily in the situation that I just created, that kind of social threat situation for you. And it's a normal experience. There are some people that experience anxiety more often and more intensely than others. It's not a different type of anxiety that you might have just experienced then, but it just gets switched on more frequently and then has more of an impact on their life. Because of that particular, that third part, our actions, if you avoid situations that make you nervous, you never learn that perhaps it wasn't as scary as what you thought it was going to be. And that those actions really help to maintain anxiety. I'm going to talk about that more in a minute. All right. Is that both? Yeah, okay. I'm on the right slide. All right, so for lots of children, that avoidance, and for adolescents as well, there's lots of different ways that avoidance might manifest. So children might be really perfectionistic and wanting to line up things in a particular way, or be really kind of obsessive over things being right. Children might have to skip school because they don't want to face a difficult situation at school. They may have troubles in the classroom or have troubles in test situations or social situations. So there's a range of different types of situations that a child might feel anxious in. And it's not necessarily kind of one specific situation. It could be a range of situations, or it could in fact just be one particular situation that a child finds nerve-wracking. All right, so what I thought I'd do is talk a little bit about those different types of anxiety that children and adolescents may experience. And I kind of want you to think about maybe children in your care, or in your school, or in your workplace, people that you have contact with that you know have anxiety, and try and think about where they might fit into these different types of anxiety that I'm going to talk about. All right, so social anxiety is one of the most common types of anxiety, and that's actually the type of anxiety I just tried to elicit in the room when I talked about kind of having to come up on stage. So this is the intense fear of being embarrassed or being laughed at. And so that's kind of the thought component of the anxiety. And children will avoid social situations because of that evaluation. Any situation that might create some evaluation, they will avoid. So lots of common fears or common situations they find difficult: meeting new people, speaking in groups, speaking to teachers or anyone in authority, any kind of situation where they might stand out, so having to talk in front of the class, or any kind of school camp. School camp is something that brings up anxiety for a lot of children because of a range of different reasons. All right, so kids with social anxiety, you might notice in the classroom, you might notice that they hesitate to answer questions. They might not be willing to volunteer information, so they're kind of quieter, more shy children in the class. You might notice that they blush or they shake or mumble when answering questions in class, or you know, perhaps even skip a school on the days where they have to give a presentation. They might talk about being sick, they might talk about stomach aches a lot, particularly when they're avoiding social situations. You might also notice that they avoid eye contact when they're talking with you, so they might look on the ground or they may look somewhere else, because that is a bit more of a threatening situation. If you make eye contact with someone, that's kind of more threatening for them, and they do it as a way of reducing the threat, and kind of, you know, if they're not looking at you, it's not as scary. All right, so that's one type of anxiety, social anxiety. And another really common type of anxiety disorders that children might experience is more generalized anxiety. So this is children who worry excessively every day about lots of things. So not specifically social situations, but a whole lot of things. So whether they've brought their school books, whether they've forgotten their assignment, what's happening at home with their family, are they going to catch the bus in time? What's happening in the world? Are there any natural disasters coming? What wars? Kind of lots of things, even family finances. So lots of kind of general worries, different types of worries. So new situations are really difficult for children with generalised anxiety. They worry a lot about making mistakes as well. So you might notice they're the children that take a lot of time preparing or doing their homework, and they take a really long time to get it perfect. They worry a lot about getting into trouble as well. And kind of, even though these children often tend not to get into trouble, they worry a lot about whether or not they will get into trouble. And just generally about their performance, they worry how they're going with school and also sport performances and any type of situation where they might have to meet a particular standard. And also they worry a lot about getting bad news, so they might kind of watch the news incessantly to see what kind of bad things are happening, and they react quite extremely to negative news. One of the key indicators for kids with this more generalised anxiety is that they ask a lot of what-if questions. And they'll be the children that have asked on the way to school 1,000, oh, what if this is not the day for the athletics carnival? Or what if my teacher's not here today? And I mean, one or two of those questions is okay for kids, but when it becomes excessive and repetitive, that's when we can consider it a problem. And it's often a really good indicator for kids that are really worrying. They ask a lot of questions and reassurance-seeking questions. And this can become really kind of a frustration point for parents and for teachers and carers. They tend to be, as I mentioned before, on that kind of high alert danger watch all the time and dwell on negative things and thinking about things that happened in the past and whether they've offended a friend, you know, months ago or a year ago. And we'll tend to seek lots of reassurance. So in addition to those repetitive what-if questions they might ask, you know, is this okay? Have I done the right thing? What do I really need to do for this assignment? Can you tell me exactly what I have to do? And I might ask a few times. They'll get distressed by exams or any kind of new project that's coming up because they worry about making mistakes. Any routine change, like camp as well, any excursions, they might worry about because of the uncertainty and not knowing what's going to happen. So they do tend to avoid lots of unfamiliar situations, so anything that might be new, they'll avoid. And they also tend to be more compliant to the well-behaved children that often get missed because they're focusing so much on their worry. They might actually be seen as more inattentive than anything rather than worried because their mind is off worrying about what could possibly happen. They're not actually focusing on their schoolwork. So they often get missed, these kids, but they're sitting there worrying, and it will be the parents that come to you to say, this is what's happening at home, they're worrying a lot. All right. So another type of anxiety which tends to happen more in younger children and it's less common in adolescents is separation anxiety, where children worry a lot about separating from their parents. It does happen in adolescents, but mostly it's for younger children. But they worry that something bad's going to happen to mum or dad when they're apart. They might be fearful of separation from any kind of family member, and they'll avoid being alone in any way. And they worry a lot about what's going to happen in the future. It's not just on separation, it's sort of a lot at night time worrying about separating, and these children will often be sleeping with their parents until adolescence. They also talk a lot about stomach aches as well, and I kind of worry a lot of physical symptoms that go with that. They have difficulty sleeping. All right, another common type of anxiety is specific phobia, where a child might be really fearful of one particular thing, like heights or the dark or dogs. Those sorts of things, and they avoid those situations. And that can have a really big impact on the child's life as well, even at school, for school excursions and camps and those sorts of things, but tend to have less kind of day-to-day impact. All right, so they're the different types, the main common types of anxiety that you might see in children. So I want to talk now a little bit about why anxiety occurs and understanding that process a little bit more. So parents often ask this question, and it's a really difficult one to answer, but why do children develop anxiety? Why is one child in my family anxious versus another child who's really confident and not outgoing? And it's often a really difficult question to answer because we don't have a really solid sense of the causes of anxiety. We have some evidence about why a child might develop anxiety, but there's lots of different pathways. One child who has anxiety might be very different to another child. Their pathway to that particular problem might be very different to another child. So we know that there's a pretty strong genetic component to anxiety, that we know anxiety runs in families. So if a parent is anxious, then the child is much more likely to be anxious as well. So it does run in families. But it's only about 30 to 40% of the variants in anxiety symptoms that the genes account for. So that leaves a huge range of influence that the environment might have on the child's anxiety. So these other three factors here are really more about what environmental impacts may have on the child over and above the genetics. And we know now that those four things aren't separate that I've got up there on the board. They really interact, that genes interact with the child's environment to predict whether or not a child develops anxiety. So we know that a parent or a teacher's or anybody in the child's life, their reaction The reaction that those parents and teachers give really impacts on the child's development of anxiety. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. We know that certain parenting styles increase a child's chances of developing anxiety. And if you kind of encourage any environment that encourages more avoidance, I talked about that before, that the more you avoid situations that make you nervous, the more likely it is that the anxiety hangs around. So any environment that helps to reinforce that avoidance and helps the child to stay away from those situations rather than facing it, helps to maintain and helps to kind of predict more anxiety later. And we also learn a lot from watching others. We learn from our parents, we learn from our teachers, we learn from our friends, and that's a really important pathway towards anxiety. If you're watching your parent be nervous about certain situations, then you'll pick up on that as well. If you see your mum avoiding social situations, then you see, okay, these situations are scary, I need to avoid them. So we learn from watching others, and that's not just parents, it can be teachers and grandparents and peers as well, and siblings. Another pathway to anxiety and disorders in particular is environment triggers. So this may be traumas, and we've heard a bit about that today. You're going to hear more about that later. So child abuse, domestic violence, situations that are traumatic for a child may increase a child's chances of developing anxiety. But I was talking to Frieda, who's talking next, about this in the waiting room before, that a lot of the children that we see in our clinic actually haven't experienced any trauma, but they still have an anxiety disorder. There's lots of different pathways towards anxiety. It's not just trauma. That is one pathway, but there are lots of different other pathways towards anxiety. All right. I mentioned this already, but I wanted to reinforce it because I think it's a really key point that avoidance is something, I love this slide, a vicious cycle. It's a very vicious cycle here. That if you avoid situations that make you nervous, you never learn that the situation is not as threatening as what you thought. And any child or environment that avoids those situations will help to maintain the anxiety and will keep the anxiety going. All right, why do we bother treating anxiety? Don't kids just grow out of it? And for some kids, yes, that's true, but we have a really good bit of information now from lots of both short-term and long-term studies showing the consequences of anxiety. So kids have difficulties concentrating in class, poorer school achievement if they're anxious, fewer friends, poorer self-esteem. They might be more likely to talk about feeling sick and unwell. And they tend to miss out on lots of different activities in their life as well. So that's the short-term consequences. But in the long term, we also know, as I mentioned really earlier, that anxiety predicts problems later in life. So it's continued life that's restricted by anxiety, so less activities, less friendships, less kind of adventuring. There's a higher risk for adolescent depression, higher risk for alcohol and drugs, as I mentioned. Kids are slower to move out of home, although that's kind of more a generational trend at the moment. But if you have anxiety, it's going to be even longer than the late 20s. less likely to achieve potential in employment as well. Because if you think about a child perhaps with social anxiety, they're perhaps not pushing themselves for that promotion or not putting themselves out there as much as a child without social anxiety. And also a higher risk of adolescent suicide as well. So I hope I've convinced you that anxiety is something important, that we should do something about it. I just also wanted to mention, I've kind of talked about the different types of anxiety, but tips to perhaps identify anxiety and how to see it in the children that you come across. So there might be the bodily symptoms of anxiety, so you might see children avoiding eye contact with you or are shaking in front of you or mumbling, or when they do their presentations you might see them kind of looking down and not being able to speak up very loudly. So there's kind of the bodily, really obvious symptoms. Avoidance that can be sometimes quite subtle but also really obvious, like missing school completely, or it could just be subtle, like in avoiding eye contact or having to have something special with them when they're doing their presentation, those sorts of things. But avoidance is a really good way for us to see how much the anxiety is having an impact on the child, because we can all experience anxiety in different situations, but it's how much we avoid it that really has an impact on our lives. Kids may tell you about the thoughts, the things that they're worried about with their questions, or they may tell you what they're worried about. It's one way of picking up on it. And also looking for patterns. When is the child missing school and what days? What's happening on those days that they're missing those activities? So looking kind of for patterns. And excessive reactions. Often you see one child being really finding some situation really much more difficult than others. And because anxiety is really normal, too often that's a really difficult thing to determine. Is this anxiety a problem, or is this just normal anxiety that a child's experiencing? And kind of there's lots of just different ways of testing that out. But for me, I suppose the strongest indicator of whether or not anxiety is a problem is how much distress the child's experiencing, and also how much impact it's having on the child's life. And it can really have an impact on the whole family, not just the child's life, but the whole family as well. And it can be really distressing for parents. It can be really distressing for the child too. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about, because I have two children as well, and I know for myself, when as a parent, I find it really distressing when my own children express their fear and anxiety. And a situation that happened a couple of years ago where my eldest daughter was starting to, I put her to bed and she was going off to sleep, and she called me in because she was really worried about somebody breaking into her room. She was worried that somebody was going to kidnap her, and she was really distressed. And in that moment, I remembered what it was like for me as a child going off to sleep and worrying about somebody kind of coming in through the window and being kidnapped. Did anyone else have that worry as a child? Yeah. And so kind of when she was telling me about this worry, I wanted to just rush in and kind of cuddle up next to her and say, everything's going to be fine, no one's going to break in, and kind of try and take away her distress. And in that moment, that's what I wanted to do. But my research, that's what I've been looking at in my work, is looking at that parents' reaction to children's fear and worry, and what parents do that might help to maintain that anxiety. So in that moment, even though all of my body was wanting to kind of comfort her and take away her distress, I chose not to, and I chose to just sit back and let her solve the problem in the situation for herself. So I was there comforting her but not solving the situation for her, not rushing in and helping her. And I asked her to come up with situations or solutions to the problem rather than me trying to fix it and rush in. Because this is what my research has been telling me. We have been able to show that parents of children with anxiety disorders do rush in more and help their children more than parents of children without anxiety problems. I use this puzzle task where I try to recreate that situation that I was talking about my with my daughter, that a difficult cognitive task where the child's really, it's one of those, has anyone done those Tangram tasks? They're just ridiculously difficult if you're not very good spatially. And so it's a really challenging task, and we sit the child there with the parent and we give the parents the answers to the task, and the child has to sit and struggle with it, and we code how much involvement, how much help the parent gives, even though we've said, this is a test of your child's cognitive ability, you want to see how well they do at the task. And then we actually code how much help the parent gives. And what we find is that parents of children with anxiety problems do actually provide more help to those children with anxiety problems. But before we go and blame parents for all of our children's problems, I did another study where I swapped children and parents around, where I had parents of children without anxiety problems also interacting with children with anxiety. And I found the same thing, that if a parent that doesn't have any anxiety and doesn't have any a child with anxiety also provided the anxious child with more help. So what this study tells us, or this series of studies tells us, is that while it's a really normal reaction to want to help a child that's more anxious and perhaps more vulnerable, it's quite a normal reaction to do that, but when it does happen, perhaps it's not the best way to respond to a child with anxiety. Because I think by rushing in and helping kids in that moment when they're just kind of potentially experiencing fear or worry, we're not teaching them that they can cope with the situation on their own. So I've been doing a series of longitudinal studies where I've been following preschool children, so at the age of 3 to 4, and following them up until the most recent assessment we did was at 12, and looking at what factors predict which children go on to develop anxiety disorders. And what we've been able to show is this kind of rushing in and helping and being more protective or kind of rushing in that moment predicts how much anxiety the child has later on. So it's not just a kind of thing that happens cross-sectionally at one particular time. It can predict the development of anxiety later in life. So I think we've become rather a risk-averse culture. I've got these pictures up of our of kind of playgrounds when I was a child, and hopefully some of you will be able to identify with these fantastic slides, slippery dips that you go right to the top and terrifyingly high, but really quite exciting. And those merry-go-rounds, anyone else recognise these from their childhood? Yeah. Well, these are the kind of playgrounds that we have now. I know this is probably an exaggerated picture, because we do have some really good risky playgrounds, but I think we are trying to protect our kids from any negative experience and trying to protect them all the time from any experience of distress or possible risk. And I think kids are missing out on some important information. So I'm suggesting that we do something different rather than kind of constantly protecting our kids from negative situations and risky situations, rather than protecting them with bubble wrap, that we get them to gently and gradually face difficult situations in their life and challenging situations. So I'm not suggesting that we throw them in the deep end and just hope that they'll swim, because I also think that's the other end of the spectrum, which is also not necessarily going to be helpful and not helpful in building relationships with our kids. What I'm suggesting is something more gradual of getting them, when they're ready, to gradually face situations that are difficult. So one way of doing this is by using our attention to shape their behaviour. So whether this is children in your own home or in your school or in your workplace, paying attention to when they're courageous. Often what happens, and this is just because of the way things work in families and in schools, that when a child gets really distressed and worried, that's when they get all their attention. They get all of this extra care and extra support, which is great. But in the long term, we know that the more attention you pay to a particular behaviour, the more likely it's going to increase. So, I mean, this is not necessarily manipulative of the way that kids are working, but it's just a natural way that things happen. So rather than paying attention to their anxious behaviour, paying attention to the times they're being courageous and encouraging more brave behaviour, and focus on the times when they're brave and courageous rather than necessarily the times when they're anxious. I'm not suggesting we completely ignore their anxiety and distress and stick our heads in the sand and hope everything will be all right, because I think it is really important for us to acknowledge children's distress and acknowledge their worry and their concerns, and then it's really how we deal with that worry and that distress that's important, and important for kids to acknowledge that it's okay to make mistakes, it's okay to be distressed, and that's a really important part of learning how to cope, because anxiety and fear are really normal emotions, and we're going to come across that in our lives in numerous times, on one particular day potentially. So being able to deal with those situations and know how to cope with those emotions is really important. So I'm not suggesting that we ignore those emotions, but paying attention to when they're courageous and just gently shaping the behaviour that we want to see. I did a study thinking about kind of making mistakes and encouraging kids to take risks and mistakes. I did one study was looking at kids with anxiety and also kids without anxiety. And I've only got 5 more minutes. All right, I'm going to move on. I'm not going to tell you that story. If you want to hear about it, I'll tell you later. Anyway, it's about the story was about taking risks, and it's really important to take risks and make mistakes in our lives, and I think that's a really important part of our parenting. And also being a coping model as well. I think it's really important. It is okay to feel distress and it's okay to feel fear, and that's a really normal emotion. I think it's okay to show children that, but it's how we cope with that that's really important. So being a coping model to the children in our lives by, I'm feeling stressed about this, but I'm not going to avoid situations. This is how I'm going to tackle this particular situation. So what not to do? Important not to dismiss the fear. I think as anxiety is really normal, we need to learn how to process that and what that emotion feels like. So by dismissing it, the child's not going to tell you next time they're feeling nervous, and we don't want to ignore it. We also don't want to constantly reassure the child, because by doing that, they never learn that they can cope with the situation. That's what often happens, because our normal reaction when a child's saying, well, what if, what's this assignment, what should I be doing, are you sure that I've got the right answer, and kind of that constant reassurance. If we provide that for them, then they never learn that actually the situation, they can handle it, even if they don't have all the information. We don't want to assist them to avoid. I've talked about this a lot today, that the more you avoid a situation, the more likely the anxiety will be to hang around. So we don't want to assist them to avoid. And we also don't want to do the opposite by pushing the child to face the situations they don't want to face. Because while that might think, yeah, okay, we want to get them to face the situation, that's what our goal is here, to get them to actually be courageous and be bold. If we push them too hard, then that's going to kind of backfire as well, and they're not likely to do it. So we need to do it at the child's pace and getting them to face those difficult situations. So again, the opposite, often parents want to do everything for the child, fix it for them, rush in, like I had that kind of situation with my daughter where I wanted to rush in and fix it for her. But instead of doing that, sitting back and letting the child handle the situation on their own. Criticising the child is often, I mean, it sounds like something that we wouldn't do as parents or teachers, but often it comes out in really subtle ways, like don't be a crybaby, or kind of just saying subtly negative, critical comments to kids when they're feeling nervous, and that's not a particularly helpful response. Often parents, teachers can increase the pressure in certain situations as well for kids who are really worrying. Increasing the pressure is not necessarily the best solution either. But I'm also saying that we don't want to take the pressure away here. It's my point of my talk today is really about we want kids to be able to face difficult situations. I also kind of tend not to like labels, labelling kids as shy or anxious, because it kind of puts them in that category that they can't change. And we know that the treatments and the programs that we have do help in making kids less nervous and less shy, and so it can be tend not to be a helpful label. All right, so in how to build resilience, I've suggested listening and encouraging and acknowledging, sorry, not encouraging, acknowledging the child's fear. So letting the child tell us what they're worried about, what is it that you're fearful of, and changing the conversation rather than always providing the reassurance by answering their questions, switch it around and start asking the questions instead. Can I have a couple more minutes? I got carried away enjoying myself too much. All right, so we want that, as I mentioned before, I've mentioned a couple of these already, you know, the gentle encouragement of brave behaviours instead and being a coping model, I've mentioned that already. And keeping our feelings in check, because it can be a really frustrating situation when you're dealing with a child that's nervous and stressed. It can be really frustrating when you've got to get the child to school or you've got to get them to present in front of others. It can be really frustrating, so keeping your feelings in check. I just want to talk to you about two of the strategies that we use in our treatment programs for kids with anxiety, which is realistic thinking. And I mentioned earlier that one of the things that happens when you feel nervous is that you think something bad's going to happen. And for people with anxiety, they tend to always focus on the negatives. They focus on the negatives in the situation and look for threat. So we teach kids what we call realistic thinking or detective thinking to get them to actually collect evidence for their thoughts try and be more realistic in their approach. And one of the main strategies that we use is what we call overcoming fear by facing fear, or what another name is gradual exposure. And I might just quickly talk about that. Here's an example of how we would... tips of how we would actually get children to face difficult situations. So we would use a stepladder and encourage children to face the difficult situation in really small steps. Each step should never be too hard, because we don't want to push them too hard, but we want to get them to gradually face that situation and allow them to experience that fear, experiencing that distress, and realise that nothing bad is going to happen. And we get them to repeat each step over and over again so they realise again that nothing bad is going to happen. And then they move on to the step. We also put rewards in at each step to encourage the kids to actually do something that terrifies them. Here's an example. If you have a lift phobia, this will be really helpful. You'll be able to treat your own phobia this afternoon. And I think the town hall lifts are pretty dodgy, so it's a really good one to practice in. So here's an example of a stepladder. We would get a child to gradually face the situations that they find difficult. So they might start with just watching a lift, then moving up. As you can see, each step is much more difficult right through to the last step, and they're practicing in different lifts and in different types of situations. And the child moves just at their own pace through that stepladder. Here's another one of a child who's fearful of being late. We would actually get him to practice being late to a class. This is just block your ears if you're a teacher, which is the majority of you. But we encourage, because the kids who worry a lot about being late to class, we actually get them to be deliberately late and realise actually nothing bad is going to happen if you're late. Or even if the teacher does say you're late and you have to go to the principal, that they can handle that situation. So you've got some examples in your handouts. All right, so what to do if you suspect anxiety? Raise it with other teachers, monitor it in different situations with different people. There's lots of help out there, school counsellors, GP, paediatrician or a psychologist. Encourage the child to seek help outside the classroom. We also think that intervening earlier is better than leaving it till late adolescence or early adulthood. Very few people with anxiety disorders seek help because they think, oh, it's going to go away, or it's not a big deal, it's not really impacting much on my life. But we find that intervening earlier is much easier. And the distinction I make is if the anxiety is impacting on the child's life in any way, if it's impacting on the family life or their friendships, then or their sleep, then it's important to get help. All right. I've got those take-home points there that you can remember. I've got there in your handouts. But I just wanted you to think about a couple of points and how this, the things that I've talked about today, how that you might take them home and think about them in your schools or in your workplace. In what ways do you think your school, your teachers or your workplace may be enabling or maintaining anxiety in young people? If what I've been saying is that the more you avoid and the more you pay attention to anxiety, the longer it's going to hang around, what are you doing within your workplaces that might be helping to maintain that? And maybe to consider some strategies and policies or practices that may actually encourage approach rather than avoidance. That's how we treat anxiety, is by getting kids to gradually face difficult situations. It's gradual. What strategies could be put in place in your schools, in your workplaces that might encourage approach rather than avoidance? I've got some resources there you can see. We've got some of our treatment programs there. And I just want to leave you with one story. This is a bit of an embarrassing story. This is a picture of me and my nappy when I was one. And it's kind of really been a metaphor for me as a parent and as an academic, as a researcher as well. This is a situation that happened when I was one. I was playing around in the mud with the hose, playing around being a bit silly, as all one-year-olds would do in a summer in Western Sydney. And I was starting to get a bit muddy and messy, and my dad decided he was going to pick me up and take me away and get me all cleaned up and washed. And Mum stopped and said, no, let's just let her sit. Let's just let her see what happens. Let's let her play in the mud. And that has really been a metaphor for me, both in my parenting and in my research, of encouraging our kids to play in the mud more and enjoy life, enjoy what risks and what messy situations it might provide for us, and being able to yes, enjoy life with all of its challenges and all of its messiness. All right, I might finish up there because I know Tim is ready and waiting for questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.